ตัสสะ नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मासम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मासम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि Reflecting on this talk that I was reading from Ajahn Chah's about the paradox of our practice, that we want something, we want freedom, fulfillment, enlightenment, and yet that's realized through the abandonment of desire. This is a very difficult kind of paradox, isn't it? A different kind of dilemma we're in. There's something in us which aspires. Well, there's this desire. There's this desire to be happy. And yet when that desire is functioning from ignorance and we keep chasing that which is unfulfilling, there's this endless frustration. So to sustain the holy life, to sustain the practice, one needs this deep yearning, really. There needs to be fire, there needs to be passion. And yet, if that, and yet also, the way is the abandonment of desire. So how to sustain this kind of yearning for truth, this passion, this kind of loving of truth, how to keep that going through the investigation of desire. One of the things I do a lot is I just read about saints. I find that very inspiring. Any kind of saint you do, whether I don't really care what tradition they're from. They seem to have profound realizations, and most of the ones that inspire me, they're always talking about pure awareness. Awareness of being a kind of primordial consciousness. And that always touches the, say, the way I was taught in Thailand, the Bhutto, now is the knowing, be the knowing. And this is a very, very simple thing. Your presence, awareness, and yet, they're somehow difficult to touch. And so I sometimes contemplate, is it now the knowing, or is now the judging? Or is now the knowing, or is now the analyzing? Or is now the knowing, or is now the criticizing? Or is now the knowing, or is now the whatever? It's quite often what we mistake is a pure awareness is actually some kind of judgment or endless lingering on something, analyzing it, trying to figure it out, trying to do something about it. And so there's this kind of subtle investment of, or gross investment of desire. A nice quote I found on renunciation. The only authentic renunciation that can clear away obstacles to spiritual progress is to abandon once and for all this constant drive for self-perpetuation, this instinctive urge to survive and dominate, which manifests in so many subtle and obvious forms, including the obsession with becoming holy or elevated. And that for me kind of really touches this paradox that like many of us have had maybe very, very like profound experiences. profound experiences of emptiness or transcendent love where barriers have disappeared. And the irony of that is then that it even increases desire sometimes, isn't it? You get somehow something comes to one unbidden, some deep, profound experience, and then of course the next day it's gone, and then there's the desire to get that, and there's the frustration. So that's why I've always appreciated the Four Noble Truths as a pointing to the problem. That the problem is this attachment to tanha. And if one, whatever practice one is doing, whatever one's investigation one is undertaking, if that, the second and third noble truth, sabodhaya nirodha, attachment to desire and the cessation of desire, if that is kept as a kind of background, anya, I think it's obviously the crux of the matter, because if the attitude is wrong, if the underlying energy is wrong, then nothing's going to work. You can listen to the sound of silence, you can investigate who am I, you can, excuse me, my throat's running out. You can do anapanasati, you can do the four elements, you can do choiceless awareness, you can do Pepsi Cola hits the spot, it doesn't matter. As long as the underlying attitude is wrong, if it's still invested with me becoming something, it can't possibly work. There's no way it can work. And that's what I've found often, that I've always needed to investigate, understand, remember what right attitude is. This is the second part of the Noble Eightfold Path, Sammasankappa. And right attitude comes from right understanding, right view, right seeing, Sammadhikkhi. And if we get that right, then we can really explore. We can explore the who am I, we can explore the sound of silence, we can explore the edges of consciousness, the whole sense of being someone doing something, all that exploration becomes terribly interesting. But if we miss it by a hair's breadth, we're finished. The distance in me becoming something. So that's helpful, I think, in whatever you're cultivating, whatever you're working with, is to continually monitor your attitude vis-a-vis the desire and the cessation of desire. That's very helpful. One of the teachings which I have found helpful is the reference to kilesa, anusaya, and asava, the kind of triad that exists of the way the mind gets preoccupied with sense consciousness, how it gets attached. And so kilesa is defilement, anusaya is latent tendency, and asava is the outflowing, the kind of obsessive outflowing of ignorance in some way. and I think that the real problem with our situation is that this we have these kind of habitual tendencies where we get preoccupied. Our attention gets preoccupied. Some bodily formation, some pain, some emotion, some memory, some fantasy. So it's either a thought or a feeling or the body, some mode of consciousness, some visual thing, continually grabs our attention. And as it grabs our attention, we become preoccupied with it. And we fight and struggle with that. And as long as we are preoccupied with the conditioned realm, we can never realize the unconditioned. There's just no way. And I think the teachings around kilesa, anusaya, asava are sort of pointing to this preoccupation with the limited preoccupation, with the relative preoccupation with the condition, with birth and death, with sense consciousness. So what we... anusaya is like habit. It is true, the English translation tends to be latent tendency, habitual preoccupation, and then asava is kind of the way it just continually flows out. And you know, the sort of expressions we have is like your buttons get pressed, or the ideas around skin diseases. So that's a good one, which I always use. You have a rash, and you have eczema or something like that, and a bit of a rash, and the rash itches, right? And you scratch it because it itches. Scratching feels good. You feel relief. But it only feels good for a while. And then after a little bit of time, of course, it itches again. And probably it itches more. And of course, the usual, habitual, anusaya reaction is to scratch. Because it's work. And you scratch. And, oh, that's nice. That feels good. And you feel some relief, some gratification. Stop. And then the rash, of course, gets better and bigger. And now the rash is like saying, scratching, scratching, scratching. And that's like asava is just flowing. You have no more choice. It's just this rash is screaming at you, scratching it. And you scratch, 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 and get no more skin. And you finally go see the doctor, and he says, you know, you should stop scratching at you. And the doctor is the Buddha. and the itch is all around tanha and desire. And the difficulty is, as one of those texts that I've mentioned, is there's the arising, there's the gratification, and there's a danger, and there's a cessation, there's the abandonment. And that's what you have to see, that these preoccupations that we have with sense consciousness, first of all, cause us a lot of suffering, just at a kind of gross, normal human level, this kind of obsessions that we have, but also, and more deeply, more profoundly, more importantly, they prevent any kind of deeper understanding, any kind of deep stillness or deep love that is possible. So we're kind of blocked, we're always blocked by these habitual patterns. And much of the task of the holy life is to sort of understand that, to understand the kind of tendencies to be preoccupied. What does your mind think about? What does it get obsessed about? How does it get obsessed? It prevents free attention. You know, it's like the tendencies to be preoccupied enslaves attention. Right? If I'm a worrier, you know, any old thing can trigger that off. Someone says something about the heating system isn't working, you know, think about it. So my attention is then caught in worry, isn't it? And it's not free. It's not free. It has no possibility of deep investigation. It's just preoccupied, so it's attached. That's what we call attachment. And so part of the task is then just to disentangle that mess. And that's the kind of really, 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 really boring part of holy life. It's endlessly dealing with one's kind of ingrained habits. You just get so fed up with it, don't you? Just the mind then goes worried again. Worried again. It's like just the force of gravity keeps sucking you into whinging about something or criticizing yourself or fantasizing about you know how it is. It goes on endlessly. So that's that takes a lot of forbearance and the ability to continue to lift attention out of these habits. Out of these habits. And this is really what samadhi is trying to do. It's not so much to achieve anything, but it's to sustain clear attention. You know, so we take simple objects like body, you know, breath, sound of silence, really simple things, and learn to sustain attention on them. And that's difficult because the habits keep grabbing it, but at least it gives you an anchor. It gives you kind of a reference point, so like the sound of silence. It's a kind of reference point, a screen to habitual tendencies. So as the mind, as the attention tries to get, or is habitually drawn into, where you go, fantasy or whatever it might be, some kind of a standard, breath, sound of silence, is giving you a reference. You've got that, you've sound of silence, you've got the breath, that you're trying to focus on. You see how the mind goes off all the time. And that's pretty much the work of samadhi, is sustaining that reference point. Then what happens is on one hand, you begin to have this kind of determined refusal to believe in your habit. Now this determined refusal is not repression. It comes from having understood your karmic predicament, as it were. And that's always the sort of first step is the willingness to engage with one's difficulties, the willingness to engage with dullness, or the willingness to engage with kind of an overly willful attitude, or the willingness to engage with a very lazy attitude, not condemn any of it. And this is where the whole idea of affectionate attention is important. It's the attention that we draw to these things has to have some sense of affection in it. It's not affection, I think we do. You contemplate that. Judging attention and affectionate attention. Now, I think that is paramount to a true understanding of the mind, because it's only through care, affection, that we truly understand. It's not through... When we just simply judge from a kind of egotistical basis, then that doesn't seem to work. So there's this need for it to be quite determined. You need the fire. You've got to, like Ajahn Sumedho uses the phrase, it's like a rat crawling, kind of gnawing through a wall. It's kind of pretty grim sort of image. But there has to be this kind of fire and determination. And yet it has to have that sense of refinement and gentility, affection. And that's a very, very difficult kind of balance to find. So on a retreat, where you're challenged now, like say, as the form of the retreat changes and there's less structure, you have a chance to experiment, and if you can give yourself up to something, if you have a form, a structure, a discipline that you put upon yourself, and your determination, your kind of rat through the wall kind of energy, is just with that structure. If you're going to be with the structure, whatever it brings up, that can give you a lot of determination, adhikāna. But that's not an egotistical becoming. It's not like you're becoming anything. It's simply you're just laying yourself open to whatever happens in that environment that you create. So it's more like a surrender of desire into something rather than a desire to get something from it. It's giving up to something and watching. So even if it's a 1 hour sitting, you're giving up to that form to witness to the way things are, and learning to sustain that witness in consciousness. And that's all we're really doing. We're learning to sustain that kind of poised awareness with the way things are. And the structures and forms are meant to do that for us. The danger of our society is complacency and luxury and distraction. These are the worst things you can have. I think computers must be a disaster for the holy life. What can be more distracting than this machine which just grabs your attention? I have a laptop now. And you could just see, you could just get caught in getting the right font. You could just, should I do, what is it, old New Roman times, I don't know, to the aerial, I guess it's, well, what for? What does the font really matter? And yet, I'm sure people spend hours figuring out what font to use. And why is that? Because the mind loves distraction. It loves to absorb into sense world and be preoccupied. And so all the trivial pursuits of our society, from, you know, reading Woman's Own to computers, or whatever it is this endless movement away from holiness, really. Movement away from that where our true home is. It's moving outwards of the sense experience. So when we take on disciplines and we practice sense restraint and these kinds of things, these are very, very helpful. Because they limit the avenues of distraction, the avenues of escape. Very, very helpful if it's done skillfully. Now, of course, within that kind of sense restraint and the simplicity of the holy life, you begin to experience these latent tendencies more obviously. You know, if I feel bored and I'm distracted, I never notice boredom. If I feel frightened and I'm distracted, I never feel fear. If I feel discomfort and I just go and lay down or pick a soft chair, I never really understand the body's discomfort. And so there's a distracting kind of way that humanity lives. There's a continual avoidance of the way things are. It's not a true investigation. So the containment, sense restraint, the rules, living under a teacher, all of this begins to it puts some pressure on you, actually, doesn't it? Renunciation is difficult. You know, to live a life of one's own preferences is also difficult. But also, renunciation has this kind of, you know, it's a bit of a screws on you. It's kind of pressure cook stuff, isn't it? But fortunately, the pressure is not, it's not kind of immoral. It's actually very safe, a safe environment. So one can begin to really experience these things. And then the task is simply to be with this the very nature of these latent tendencies. Not make a judgment about it, but to see them and to stop scratching. Simply to stop scratching. Now that feels very foreign. You know, if you've ever had a skin disease, then just the satisfaction of scratching is so nice that to give that up, you know, well, what for? Well, because your skin's falling off. You're breaking out in blisters, and you're not putting an end to the disease. So quite often this is the way you get insight, is you sit there scratching yourself for whole whatever. And you realize, actually, you know, this isn't working. I've been scratching this doubt, or I've been scratching this aversion, I've been scratching this resentment, I've been scratching this boredom, I've been scratching this whatever. And I don't seem to be getting out of this. And then you have to go back to the drawing board. What is the itching and scratching? What is the itching and scratching of doubt? What is the itching and scratching of complaining? What is the itching and scratching of dullness? What is the itching and scratching of fantasy? Why does the mind like to go into that? What's the satisfaction? The mind is seeking satisfaction, right? So it does these things for a reason. I mean, it seems pretty perverse for people to worry, but they do it. Why do people worry? What's the satisfaction of worry? And this is the kind of investigation you have to kind of go into. Obvious things. What's the satisfaction of running away from fear? Because we're afraid of fear. It doesn't put an end to fear. So then, like bearing with unfulfilled desire, like bearing with the scratching, is part of the way of cessation. So if your practice is again focused on desire, tanha, without judgment, but with pure awareness, then through the witnessing of that, you begin to experience the cessation of desire. And that's what Nibbana is about, Nirodha. But if you're still focused on experience, if you're trying to get an experience, if you're trying to become enlightened, you know, if you're trying to get anything and you're not looking at desire, you're going to miss the mark. You can't get it. So as always, the experience is irrelevant. The experience of fear, the experience of worry, the experience of doubt, these are just the way it is, right? It's the attachment and engagement with them that you have to learn about. So you'll try practices, you know, you experiment. You do things with sleep, or you do things with sitting longer, or walking longer. You can play around a lot and experiment. You challenge yourself. And you really go against your defilement, do things. But not in any kind of a brutal way. You have to be very, very sort of wise and clear about what the practice might be. the kind of some of the very interesting practices are like when the mind has some kind of quietness and it's not sort of obsessed with the anusaya and asava, and the outflows of delusion aren't so strong, then you get the very interesting practices of being interested in being interested. Being aware of being aware. The mind affectionately looking at the mind. And these are very interesting. And this is where you get really to the sense of separation and the whole sense of me doing something, really. So if your mind is very quiet, you might just kind of try that. Just like affectionate attention, the mind gazing at the mind, interested in being interested. So these kinds of really subtle kinds of things. That's one way of kind of investigation. Another way is through stillness. Stillness is a very kind of interesting, when you know the subtleties are just deep stillness. Any movement, you know, any movement of will or whatever, you continue to observe that and continually contemplate deep stillness. That's a very kind of, that can be very rewarding in investigation. Another way is like emotionally through just profound love. Kind of unconditioned love for all, you know, each moment, each condition, total loving acceptance of whatever this moment brings. It's another kind of interesting avenue of approach to ultimate truth. The sound of silence is quite interesting to just investigate that. Like with the sound of silence, just to hear that sound in a very pure way without any sense of me listening. Just pure sound. Or the same way with the body, if you're observing the body, to just take your attention to just a very, very pure sensation of pressure or heat or vibration. This is called the practice around the four elements. And in that, there's no, what you bring your attention to is the whole perceptual overlay of me doing anything. The whole conceptual structure of me practicing is abandoned. Non-perception. It's just pure awareness and just a pure feeling of vibration, solidity, movement, in a very pure way. And through all these kinds of more subtle kinds of practices, the sort of transparency of self and the sense of separation and alienation that continually dissolves. So it really kind of depends on what Mara is bringing up for you, or what your karma is, or how long you've been practicing, or you know, whatever. But whatever it is, that's the work. If you want subtle practice when you've got gross stuff going on, then that's not, you know, that's pointless, isn't it? If you've got some huge kind of upheaval of emotion, that something is triggered, then fine, go right to that. See that with pure awareness, welcome that. Just pure awareness on that. The mind's very, very still. And there's more kind of refined investigation, that's okay too. So there's nothing lost in the practice of pure awareness, sheer awareness, pure presence. And then the, you know, the kind of simplest teachings are, like Lompo, it's very direct, and pure presence is ever transcendent. Just kind of continually bringing attention to that very, very simple sheer awareness, pure presence, and trusting in that. That whatever helps you to do that, the sound of silence, the breath, body meditation, just being present, and really trusting in that in a very profound way. And not giving these habits any more energy. You know, quite often what happens, we linger. You have some habitual thing will come up into the mind, and then rather than just totally not giving it an inch, you just kind of analyze it a bit, think, I should be doing something about this. There's a kind of lingering. There isn't the real kind of profound letting go. And sheer awareness is just that pure presence. Simple, direct knowing. In developing your own intuitive way of practice, just the word intuition is good. So, you know, sometimes you just feel, hey, I'd like to do this, and do it. Give it a go, see what happens. Try things out. And if you're making, say, one of your more fundamental reflections an attitude, and attitude vis-a-vis desire, then you'll learn intuitively how, you know, you'll feel your attitude is much too harsh, you know, much too willful, and you'll be able to just be more receptive. Or you'll feel your attitude is much too accommodating, much too indulgent, and you'll just get a sort of wisdom going. Or you'll feel your attitude is much too judgmental, and you'll develop much more sense of openness and forgiveness. Yeah? And these can just be like momentary things. You know, they don't have to be like a practice you do for an hour. You just feel the mind becoming too tight. And you just through experience, you say, you just kind of know intuitively how to back off. Mm-hmm. Or you just feel the whole thing getting too spaced out. And you put some crispness in it, and so on and so forth. And it's very much like surfing, or you know, walking a tightrope, or very much a balance act, often. And this is the kind of training that we're involved in. It's a very gentle training, very beautiful kind of training. You learn about yourself. Okay, I'll leave that for tonight.
Tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Six kinds of throat lozenges. Great place to be sick. Love it here. About 10 kinds of medicine sitting on my table. I was thinking how fortunate I really am to be in a place like this, and to have people who care for me, and to be able to practice Dhamma. I'm very grateful and fortunate to be here. contemplating also just like poor people, homeless people who have all kinds of awful illnesses, have no family, have no friends, live alone. It's very difficult, very lonely kind of way to live one's life. So we have this, this lovely Sangha. And I certainly feel privileged to practice in this way. This new hall is the first retreat in here. One of the things about this hall, when people who are not maybe into spiritual practices, when they come in here, perhaps tradespeople or so on, they come in and we can see sometimes they just stop by the silence. I found that in Wellington also, our hall there is nice, nice meditation hall there. And workers would come in working on something and they'd come into the hall and their minds would just stop by the silence. And then what is it about silence that is, especially for contemplatives, that is so, it's like coming home for me. I love the ceremony's name, this is a great name. Kri Silent Sage, or Munindo Silent Sage, or Shakyamuni, the Silent Sage of the Sakyans, sense of inner silence. Silent Sage, obviously not just one who doesn't say any words, because inwardly we can be full of noise and chatter, and outwardly we can be very silent. So it's something about an inner stillness. The way we can approach that in Buddhism is through a correct attitude, a right way of paying attention. If you look at the Four Noble Truths, the Second Noble Truth, Samudaya, is that the cause or origin of suffering is attachment to craving. And then the Third Noble Truth, Nirodha, is cessation, the cessation of craving, the ending of craving, the extinction of craving. And the way the practice seems to work is that through having an attitude of non-craving, of a silent witness to the various kinds of karma that we experience, the tendencies towards craving in the various ways, all that movement and struggle, that begins to end. Not by us ending it in a kind of willful way, an egotistical way, but by no longer engaging in it, no longer being preoccupied with it, no longer attaching to it. So attachment and craving are obviously very important. So one of the words I use a lot in my practice is desirelessness, because I find it's terribly important to get the right attitude in the way I witness to life. And it's this very word awareness, which is it's quite common coinage with us, isn't it? Sort of, everyone says be aware or be awake, and so it can, sometimes we fail to sometimes investigate, say, what awareness might mean. Yes, this is the most fundamental thing, the most important thing. And for me, if it's in line with the Second and Third Noble Truths, if suffering is caused by attachment to desire, then the cessation of tanha, the cessation of desire, is nibbana. It seems to me the only way that can be realized is if that witnessing consciousness, if the attention, awareness, is desireless. So what I try to do in my practice is I just throw that into the pot, as it were, to say desirelessness. And then that's different than saying I shouldn't have desire, because I shouldn't have desire is still an ego statement, isn't it? I am someone who has this thing called desire and I shouldn't have it, which is just another form of tanha, vibhava tanha, craving to get rid of. So to come to a kind of purity of attention is something we need to do again and again and again. And And there are many ways and words that this is talked about. Lompo has a lovely vocabulary around these things. Still center of being, the intersection of the timeless with time, now is the knowing, be here now, Ram Dass's thing. There's kind of many ways that that's talked about. Pure presence is ever transcending. And these are the most direct kind of teachings, aren't they? Pure presence is ever transcending. Be aware. I think the text I was reading, a Mahayana text, Mahamudra is simple awareness. If you can correct me if I'm wrong. But you get some very fancy names for that. Some people call it God. And that's dangerous around here, maybe. But anyway, it seems to me very, very important that we are very, very clear and understand how we are paying attention. What is the quality that I am observing my breath? Or what is the quality in which I do metta bhavana? Or what is the quality of the way I investigate the different kinds of defilements that I'm experiencing in the mind? What is that quality of attention? And I think if we get that right, then we find that balance between the repressive and the indulgent. And I think if we get that right, everything will come right from that, because the attention is desireless. And in the way of reflection, this is the way we can use language as a suggestion which helps us to awaken to that particular area of investigation. So if I say to myself, I shouldn't have desire, that's not reflective, that's an egotistical command, which is a tyranny, which is oppressive, which makes you want to really hate Buddhism. You shouldn't be this or shouldn't be that. So that would be wrong view, that would be wrong effort, that would be wrong practice. Because it's still coming from a sense of me and ownership and I, and there's something wrong with me and I should become something else. And the attention isn't pure. But through that kind of I shouldn't be this way, there can be no insight. Because there's already a judgment, there's already a struggle. And it's in a very joyous kind of way to function. But if one uses the reflective mind and one just kind of throws that into the mind, right? This desirelessness. Just put that thought into the mind, desirelessness. And what I find for myself, what happens is then that very area of desire becomes somehow illuminated. You know, like if I'm just walking on the meditation path and I put in the word desirelessness, I find that really, really helpful for me makes me attentive to the quality of attention, how I'm actually attending to the feet touching the ground or the feeling of the wind or whatever. So I would suggest that, you know, in your practice, again, this word practice is overused maybe, cultivation. I like the way the Chinese call it cultivation. But do consider, you know, when you're walking or when you're developing your object of meditation or you're eating your food or whatever you're doing, what is the quality of attention? And do try to throw in that word desirelessness. Not as a command, but as a consideration. So the second noble truth around attachment to craving, this attachment manifests in many ways, as just all the love and hate scenarios we have with ourselves and people, the various kinds of views and opinions we hold. These are grounded in desire, craving to know, the craving to be informed. So there's also like just the rituals that we go through. Some people approach meditation in a very kind of ritualistic way. They think if they continually do something, a mantra, or watch the breath, or walk slowly, or eat slowly, or visualize something, if they just continually do that, somehow they'll get enlightened. This is curious. But just some kind of an activity like lighting incense, or getting sprinkled with water, or doing a technique, somehow you grind it out, and at the end of it you get this answer called enlightenment. I think enlightenment's a bit more subtle than that. It can't be just a sort of grinding out of technique. That we call silabhata paramasa, belief in rites and rituals. And we, you know, we Westerners, we don't think that we are, we're not superstitious, but there are a lot of superstitions that go down. And any kind of idea based in time, if I do this analysis, if I do this practice or whatever, that somehow here's me here now, right? And I churn this thing out, and then at the end of 1, 2, 3, 5 years, there'll be enlightenment. That's a kind of ritual. Silabhata paramasa. The ways of attachment are defined in the text in four ways. There's attachment to sensuality, kama upadana, attachment to views, ditta upadana, attachment to beliefs and rites and rituals, belief in rites and rituals, silabhata paramasa, upadana, and attachment to ignorance. And this is the way craving kind of takes hold and manifests. The mother of them all, the mother and father of them all, is ignorance. Attachment to ignorance. Everything else is based upon that. And ignorance is a wrong seeing. It's not understanding clearly. And where we get right seeing, where we see clearly, is when we have the willingness to pay attention without desire. We have that willingness to observe our situation without desire. And specifically when we're willing to look at suffering. So any kind of discontent one experiences in this retreat, the practice and the liberation is always in that moment. It's right where it's happening. It's the only place it could be. So if it's with flu, or with a gruel meeting, or cold wind, or boredom, or it's like if you're walking along the meditation path and you're walking back and forth thinking, what the hell am I doing this for? This is crazy. Wind is blowing. It is back for a bloody hour. I'm walking back and forth. You guys must be nuts. I mean, that comes up in my mind. I could be doing weaving. Doing something important, making carpets for Lumpur. Or I could be something good, I could be studying, walking back and forth, back and forth. Now, if you're really looking at the movement of the mind and not believing in it, then that's a movement that can be known. Desireless witnessing to that. If there isn't desireless witnessing, then that movement becomes what? Shut up. Stop thinking. Go back to your feet. And there's repression, or you believe it, but then you're really in trouble. Because then you start to think about what else you could be doing, all the important things you could be doing, and the mind just starts to fantasize, or you just leave. That's another way. After 20 minutes, you just go and you do something else. Okay? But just desirelessly witnessing too the feeling of this is pointless, or this is useless, or I'm getting somewhere. Or I'm not getting anywhere. These are all the movements. These are all the movements of thought and preference and all the rest of it. Now, the more we can sustain this kind of desireless attention, the more we intuit the refuge of Buddha knowing Dhamma. This is what we mean by Bhutang Sarangachami. That still witnessing to the way things are is not the movement. Anything that moves is an object, it can be known. When it's known as a movement, that knowing is the refuge. So when we sustain this sense of just still witnessing to whatever's happening on 1 hour of walking path, whatever, you know, you like it, you dislike it, you know, you find it really peaceful, pleasant, unpleasant, cold,
boring, exciting, interesting insights. You walk into a tree, whatever. If you can just sustain that witnessing conscious on that, then you begin to realize cessation. This is how the mind becomes more calmed. Not through us calming it down through willful effort, but that we are not, you know, just we're not buying into the desire mind. So by witnessing to something like a feeling of this is useless, and not making any comment about it, that it's right or wrong, that it should be useful, just witnessing to that, you begin to realize cessation. Cessation of craving. But if you don't witness to that, and then you try to rationalize it in your mind, or you try to make it important, or you just walk away from the walking path, you tend to create, you tend to act on desire, act on tanha. And the tanha, and the mind never settles, really. It just keeps itself kind of restless. So the kind of way the retreat works is that one has these very simple parameters and very simple routines, and the surrender to that, give up to that form. Don't follow personal preferences if you can, the best way, and then watch personal preferences, liking or disliking, and just stay with that kind of still witnessing, and keep throwing up that word desirelessness. And the difficult part is, of course, when the like with pain, say, you know, you have a lot of maybe body pain sitting around here for so many hours, or maybe unresolved emotions, or strong, you know, anything strong emotionally, physically, psychically, it is very overpowering. Then if it's very, very powerful, then there's a strong desire around it very often. Strong doubts or fears, then there's the strong desire. But in Dhamma, all experiences have the same value. And we are not concerned about the experience, we're concerned about the desire. This is important. It doesn't really matter if you have, again, you know, really exquisite experiences or boring experiences or ugly experiences. They are simply experiences. They arise and pass away. But that silent witnessing is the trick, really, that objective knowing. So then the ability to witness to desire in a desireless way allows desire to cease. The ability to witness to strong sexual desire with desirelessness, just to witness it in the body. The attachment goes off into fantasy, the repression, one feels guilty about it. The middle way, lust feels this way in the body. And to bear witness to that is the calming of the mind, is the cessation of tanha. Fear, strong fears come into consciousness, same thing. Awful memories, maybe something you did really nasty, you know, these are the extremes, something really awful you did to someone brings up a strong sense of guilt or shame or fear or something like that. Witness to that, don't run away from it. Don't create a self around it, just know it with desirelessness. Creative things that you're going to make and build, and the great desanas you're going to give your mother-in-law after the retreat, or whatever arises in your mind, don't believe in those. Know those in a desireless way. All the fantasies that the mind wants to go into. Self-judgments, thinking your practice isn't up to the mark, that your samadhi is no good, know those with desirelessness. Know it all, just with desirelessness. File it all away as changing stuff, coming and going, and not who you really are. Because that desireless knowing is it knows all these things as objects, and it is not them. They arise because of various causes. The stronger the desire, the more difficult it is to witness it, isn't it? The more difficult it is. Things that have been bottled up for a long time, if one has avoided them with distraction, then of course the desire is to distract. So try to avoid distractions. Don't build shelves. You only have to clean your kuti once a week. You know, kind of do simple manual things, that's all right, darn your socks or whatever you want to do, but be very, very wary of just getting into distraction, projects. You don't have to learn Pali this next 3 months, or because this is what the desire mind will now do. You know, it's like you're starving the tiger. This was Ajahn Chah's image. You know, you get the tiger in the cage and you start to starve it. You don't feed it. So we're not feeding it now. We're not giving any distraction. And, you know, the tiger starts to kind of get weak. And it starts to sort of purr and lays down, lying there. And they'll say, "Rawr!" And you look. Did you hear that, Yutta? And so then you're this is like, you get a fantasy like that. I got that. The second vasa. I, to kill the boredom, I'd learn chanting. So I'd do walking meditation, and I'd do standing practice. I'd learn chanting standing up. I like to learn it standing up. And then I do sitting practice, so I alternate sitting, walking, chanting, about 45 minutes of each. And then during one walking session, an old pop song came up into my mind, like a Rolling Stone or something like that. And so of course I grabbed it and started to sing it. And it was really nice. Oh, thank goodness, something interesting. Walking along, you know, remembered a few lines, a few verses, then of course I couldn't remember anymore, and then I'd have to do the same ones again and again, and then I got bored with it. But then, of course, I'm stuck with it. With this damn Bob Dylan song in my head for hours and days. That's karma. That's karma. You're going to bite into it. It tastes good. It's all right. Go for it. Really nice. But then, of course, there's the repression. You know, I'm bored with it. Okay, I won't do that anymore. And it comes off by itself. It's like a broken record. Shut up. Get back to your feet. Doesn't work. So, like, be careful of fantasies. Because any fantasy that you bite into, it'll be fun for a while, but then after a while it'll be so boring. So boring. And that's the way Mara works, isn't it? Mara says, just a little bit. So on some hand, we have like, in like finding the balance, finding desireless attention, like saying that, like that rolling, that, like a Rolling Stone kind of song, it's like in one point, if I would have not bought into that song, then that would be, I would have cut it right there, right? I wouldn't have bought into the pleasure of that fantasy. But having bought into that, right? Then I had to bear with the karma of that. So desireless attention was bearing with the echo. So it's like at some stages you can just say no. But at some stages you've got no choice. It's going to just come into consciousness. Things are going to come into consciousness. And I think this is the adept in effort learns about what is the difference between suppression, repression, and indulgence, and what is the middle way. I keep kind of emphasizing that. And for me, the key is to come back to desirelessness. What does that mean in the way you pay attention? Now, the idea of cessation, Nirodha, is a very beautiful idea. Because you can notice cessation at the end of a thought. You can take a pop song and actually think it deliberately, but just kind of you can watch it end. Take an idea and watch it end. And actually, in meditation, when we notice that we're fantasizing, or when we notice that we're worrying, or when we notice that we're complaining, if we really have clear mindfulness, we're with that, we can notice that the end of the thought is actually cessation. Cessation of self, cessation of becoming, cessation of craving. And in that silence, that's what we mean by nirodha. When there's no sense of having to do anything, having to become, having to get rid of, having to attain, having to figure out, all these different programs that we put upon ourselves, this need to do something all the time, to become, to get rid of, this struggle. But in, and that quite often manifests in thought. That's where the, that's where all the attachments go. So if you can notice, like, when you, if you're sitting in meditation and then, you know, like your mind is racing on about something and someone sneezes, and all of a sudden you notice, oh, I'm in the meditation hall. Well, in that moment, that's the moment of cessation. You can actually notice when the mind's not thinking, when it's not becoming. There's that sense of centeredness and peace. And the more you notice that, the more you're inclined towards that. To get the right attitude depends on our personality. My own personality, I needed to do a lot of metta bhavana. And I was pretty cynical, and I still have some bit of cynicism left. But I found metta bhavana very difficult because I thought that it was sentimentality. And so I was going through one of my really dark, ugly moods at Wat Bapong, and Ajahn Ananda, who was then Samanera Ananda, was getting very high and radiant on metta bhavana. He could do that, and I was just sort of going through kind of a lot of restlessness and aversion and kind of getting there and kind of whinging stuff. Which Ajahn Chah would just say, gump, didn't help me much. I'm just kind of bearing with my karma, and Ananda comes up to me, and he has this really kind of amazing sutta on some bodhisattva loving every blade of grass in the universe and loving every creature. And so he gives me the sutta to read. And, you know, I was just feeling really down and angry and negative. And I just wanted to basically kick him in the teeth when he gave me that. It didn't stimulate any metta in me. It just stimulated more aversion. Because I felt he was just putting a trick on me. This guy's just wanting me to be something that I'm not. And I'm not. I don't love everyone, damn it. I hate everyone. And that's the truth. So it was a kind of like this sort of, I felt really oppressed by that. Just shut up, I'm on your own bloody business. I'm going to be mad if I want to be mad, damn it. And so, I mean, I didn't really understand metta then, because I thought it was a kind of replacement therapy or something. And there's no way I was going to do that. I'd rather be miserable than do that. But then, of course, then I realized that metta is an attitude of openness. It's an attitude of allowing. It's an attitude of non-judgment, I suppose, initially. Non-discrimination. And that's what I needed to do to be with the negative states of mind that I was experiencing. I had to have a non-judgmental attitude to the anger, whatever was going on. I had to have a sense of allowing it to be there. And that really is what metta is about. So metta, which is done in a kind of may I be well, may you be well, can be very uplifting. And some people really use that very well for that kind of upliftment. But if you find that too sentimental and it makes you more angry or more cynical, then do contemplate what metta is, the opposite of discrimination. So, like, discrimination and discernment in Buddhism is used to see suffering and non-suffering, right? But because we have karma, and because we're going to experience all kinds of negative and positive things, we have to be willing to allow that to become conscious. Right? And that's where metta comes in, the willingness to feel angry. Not as an indulgence, but as a recognition of one's karma. So like Ajahn Sumedho, then I went to him and he said, don't just, you know, so what about this anger problem? And then they'll give me this book and I want to kick his teeth in. And of course Ajahn Sumedho was more skillful. He just told me to swear. He said, just walk up and down the meditation path and just swear every bloody word you know. And I'm going, of course, that was it. Obviously, I had to get it out first. I had to look at it before I could be aware of it. Well, before that, I just thought that awareness was a kind of judgment. So I was trying to hold everything down, be nice, and getting more and more depressed. And it was very nice to walk up and down and swear. Now, I didn't do that for 25 years, fortunately. It's obviously just an initial technique to get things conscious. But once things are conscious, then metta means the willingness to allow things to be there. So for me, that the metta practice was very important, not in that kind of dualistic me and you way, but more in the transcendent way of all things arise because of causes. They're natural. They're not right or wrong. And that their uprising into consciousness is in some way perfect. You know, it's not... Who am I to say that I shouldn't feel angry? Who am I to say that lust shouldn't arise in consciousness? Who am I to say that fear shouldn't? Because it's not mine. It's some kind of mysterious program in nature. And when I can, for me at least, that metta bhavana as an attitude then, was tremendously important to get to really understand what awareness was. That awareness did have a heart component, did have a kind of openness in it. Whereas I tended, with the practice of awareness, where I tended to err, was I tended to use awareness more as a kind of discriminative tool. You know, I could always say, oh yeah, this is suffering, and yeah, I'm not weak here, I've got to be stronger here. And God, I've got to put more effort forth there, and I've got to stop thinking while I'm on that walking path. And it's just kind of, and I found that really oppressive. So it tended to be kind of like a judgment all the time. I was judging myself, and I didn't find it very uplifting. So then I found, like, you know, in kind of to open the heart more, and to feel and allow things to be there. The discriminating mind was still working, you know, it was still functioning because that was still there, but there wasn't this heavy overlay of me trying to become enlightened or me trying to get rid of my desires. So that's my character. I don't know what your character. I could imagine someone who, say, you know, like, I don't think there's anyone here like that, but let's say someone who ordains in Thailand and then drinks Pepsis all day and sleeps for 12 hours and then chats up the ladies who come and bring the dana and then smokes cigars when no one's around and then gets lots of money and buys Playboy magazines. That kind of person probably needs a bit of criticism and judgment. So metta bhavana, it's an attitude to balance out a certain kind of attitude. If someone is very, very lustful and enjoying following lustful energies, then the practice of metta will kind of welcome the lustful energies. Oh, wonderful. And just the fantasize of it probably wouldn't be very fruitful. It wouldn't work well. So each of us has to find some kind of a balance where that still center of knowing begins to function in a more and more unshakable way. In a more and more unshakable way. And you see, that's independent of experience. That's the beauty of it. Whatever experience you have doesn't really matter. It's that sense of witnessing to it with this pure attention, this pure presence, this mahamudra, and it's still center of being, the intersection of the timeless with time. Getting to that, then the rest will take care of itself. The rest is just karma, really, coming and going according to causes. And so we, you know, the language we use about determinations and patience and faith, these are all ways of just trying to point to one thing. Just to one thing all the time. This is the way it is now. When it's not working, when it's not working, the signs will be bodily tension again. So pay attention to your body. When it's not working, the mind won't be happy. There'll be no stillness. These are the signs.
But don't try to get the stillness as an act of will, but witness to the very feeling of not being still and trust in that. Witness to the feeling of not being successful and trust in that. Witness to the feeling of, like, you know, let's say like you finish your meditation, that, you know, the bell rings and it's been an hour's meditation and your mind's been all over the shop, and then the bell rings and you finally come to, you finally hear, and then that's the moment of awakening. Great. But don't put, if you put into that, oh God, it's a terrible meditation, I'm a no good meditator, you're lost again. You're lost yourself here. So rather try to, you know, what I find more helpful is say, oh great, I'm here again. Like a sense of gratitude and welcoming, and what does it feel like to be here now? Okay, I'm here now, this is where my body feels. This is what it feels like regret, or that I'm a hopeless meditator. Because then you're beginning to not believe in time. And I think where the delusion lies is we think that time is some kind of, like ego, is some kind of continuity in time. And then when there is a gap there, we think, oh, I've lost something. And we try to find ourselves in time. But actually that sense of presence is always there. And we get it all very confused. So whatever moment there is that sense of awakening, then learn to broaden that into, well, this is where it feels now. So kind of relaxed, receptive attention. Even just at the end of the bell. Great. And that's it. You've got it. That's all. You don't have to get anything. But then the desire, like, oh, I haven't been, I have to try harder. You're caught in grasping again, trying to get something. And there isn't the pure presence. Trust in pure presence. So there's the feeling of, I have lost something. I haven't been mindful. That's in the moment. Now if you assume that you are someone who has lost something and you haven't been mindful, you create a sense of self. And from that premise, then you try to find something which is you being mindful. That's delusion. You're a sense of self in time. But if in that moment where there's the feeling, I haven't been mindful, there is just knowing of that thought as something in the moment, as a sankhara, just that, that's pure presence, transcendence. And if you trust in that, you begin to go through the sense of time into the sense of eternity. You begin to intuit that. But as long as there's the belief that I am someone who hasn't been mindful, then you'll always be someone who's trying to be mindful, but you'll never be mindful of that very sense of me trying to be mindful. So then there'll still be Sakaya Ditti, self-view, trying to get something, and then there'll be the sense of defeat and failure. Then you'll feel really dejected, I can't do this, and then you read Time magazine or distract your mind out of some kind of relief. So I find it very helpful to kind of, I find these very simple things like desirelessness and then timelessness, is to see that very sense of me having to become something as something right now. It's something that can be known right now. And then then that whole sense of self keeps dissolving, and there's that you begin to intuit that the pure presence is eternal. It's always here and now. And what the kind of unconditioned or the deathless, what these words really mean. But as long as I'm looking for something in time, there's always this kind of, well, I've got to get something. I have to get rid of something.